Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, I'm seeing a word crop up a lot lately in terms of healthcare pricing, and it's not one we're accustomed to seeing.
And what would that be, Mark?
Transparency. Transparency in healthcare pricing.
And that has really taken off as a trend in recent weeks since we had Stephen Brill on the show talking about his Time magazine piece on the arbitrary nature of healthcare pricing. A number of organizations are starting to bring their pricing out into the light of day.
The Affordable Care Act is certainly spurring open pricing information on the insurance exchanges. We've seen states like New York and California reveal insurance prices that are markedly lower than what was offered on the individual market in the past.
And did you see the General Accounting Office recently released reams of healthcare pricing data at the request of Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, who wanted to know how the Affordable Care Act was impacting insurance plan pricing on the exchanges?
This is information that simply wasn't publicly available before. And while 20% of the nation's insurers didn't provide that data, 80% did. And we now have a pretty clear document on health insurance pricing and how it differs across all 50 states.
Well, it's going to be so interesting to see if there's a direct correlation, Mark, between the increase in pricing transparency and a decrease in costs. I don't know that there will be, but it would certainly be great if that happened.
Then another thing that's overdue, though many have tried creating a system that clearly facilitates patient engagement and ongoing communication with their care providers, another trend that is expected to grow.
David Chase founded Microsoft's healthcare business, which sought to create a user-friendly patient portal. He's now launched his own company, Avado, that offers a patient engagement system that he hopes will facilitate the patient-provider communication loop. He's got his eye on developments in the industry that are going to facilitate that incredibly important and often overlooked intersection in healthcare.
Lori Robertson from factcheck.org shares another misrepresented fact about healthcare reform. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with David Chase in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Confusion and the healthcare law are contributing to the employment rules as we draw closer to the October 1st deadline for insurance exchanges to be online and ready for perusal. It begs the question, what do folks really know about these exchanges and how will they work? Turns out thousands of folks are being trained and paid right now to answer those and any other questions folks might have about the insurance exchanges. There's been a hiring boom of insurance exchange navigators whose job it will be to provide the confused and uninitiated vital information to help them navigate those online insurance exchanges. Analysts are predicting a hiring boom as the activity around the Obamacare deadlines ratchets up, up to 9,000 new hires expected to meet the demand. Meanwhile, another state is on the books with their insurance rates for the state-based insurance exchanges. Maryland's insurance commissioner just revealed rates that are coming in at more than 50% below the going rates on the individual market. Nine companies are providing policies for consumers in Maryland, which is boasting some of the most aggressively lowered insurance rates in the nation. Some, though, are concerned those rates at that low level will be unsustainable. Medicare, that's a different story entirely. With the SGR formula for compensating doctors treating Medicare patients still not fixed, more docs are simply opting out of treating that population. The number of doctors opting out of taking new Medicare patients nearly tripled in the last 3 years. Those medical professionals citing poor compensation rates and increased government restrictions as the reasons. And when it comes to practicing medicine, why are the treatment protocols what they are? A new study out in the New England Journal of Medicine found that the answer is often, well, just because. In a review of 363 studies of papers on clinical practices, the currently used drug or procedure was found to be no better and often worse than older procedures. And in addition, the study found many doctors persist in using practices that have been proven ineffective. In fact, 40% of the established practices studied were found to be ineffective or harmful, but still used. 38% were found to be actually beneficial, and 22% were inconclusive. Among the most harmful practices persisting with current protocols, synthetic hormone treatment for postmenopausal women, high-dose chemotherapy. And the study's author says it often takes 10 years between discovery of harm before the practice is actually phased out. out. Hard to argue we can avoid harm by practicing prevention. A new study out of the Cleveland Clinic shows that 1 ounce of dark chocolate provides 16% of the daily recommended allowance of magnesium, which promotes heart health. An ounce of prevention? Why not two or three? I'm Arianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with David Chase, founder and CEO of Avado, a patient portal and relationship management system aimed at bringing the patient directly into the care team. Mr. Chase founded Microsoft's healthcare business, guiding Microsoft to a market-leading position in health IT. He is responsible for numerous health IT and consumer engagement startups and has received or implemented over 100 health IT systems across the country, from small rural settings to large hospital systems. Mr. Chase earned his MBA from the Kellogg School at Northwestern and is a regular health industry contributor to Forbes, TechCrunch, Washington Post, and Reuters. Mr. Chase, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, Dave, we seem to be really leaping off in healthcare, very exciting crossroads, though I think in healthcare we're always at an interesting crossroads. But right in front of us are the enormous policy shifts that are coming with the Affordable Care Act. Lots of technological breakthroughs are surrounding us. And you say that we're still at what I sort of call the garage phase of innovation in technology. And you liken it to the early adoption of search engines like Google that transformed how we utilized information on the internet. So from your days at Microsoft to this current revolution in healthcare information technology, paint us a picture of how you see the market developing in the moment. And also, can you tell me how you think the healthcare community is ready for this revolution culturally?
Sure. I would say to begin with, there's a term used in healthcare that is becoming a big, big focus called the triple aim, which is, improve outcomes, lower cost, and improve the patient or consumer experience. And that is driving the change. And really what's driving that is the incentives around reimbursement, where it makes those things really central, whereas historically, basically activity has been rewarded. And the way we see things developing is, in the past, the healthcare system has been a very siloed system where there's a lack of coordination. We really see things become more patient-centric, more accountable, and more coordinated. And the most important medical instrument, and I put that in quotes, of the future is going to be communication. And that really squarely puts not only the various members of your care team from a professional side, but the kind of forgotten members of the care team, the patient, the family, and the 70 million caregivers that are frankly delivering the majority of health care today.
Well, I think, Dave, that's a great jumping off point to a chance to ask you about patient relationship management, which is an area that you've called the new frontier in health IT. And it strikes me that for these last couple of years, we've had so much focus on the meaningful use, certainly, of electronic health records and of health information technology, and we're continuing to struggle towards that triple aim, particularly around prevention and managing chronic illness. But you've said that what's lacking across many of these efforts is infrastructure to engage that most important partner in healthcare, the patient, and that's the concept behind your new patient engagement tool at Avado, this patient relationship management. So tell us about that, if you will.
I guess it begins with part of what I mentioned a moment ago, that the majority of healthcare is delivered by non-professionals, and our tagline is care beyond the clinic. And we say that other 99% of your life that you're not in front of the doctor is really critical. And it's critical to really weave in the patients, the families, and caregivers of full-fledged members of the care team. I mean, in the old model, the 100 or so systems that I've reviewed or implemented over the years, I took a step back and thought about, well, what's the purpose from a health IT perspective of a patient in those systems? And frankly, it was to be a vessel for billing codes. That's what our incentive system rewarded, and that's what we got. And the key insight that the organizations that are really, I call them the triple aim champs, that are really doing the best job, is they recognize that for 3/4 of all the dollars we spend on healthcare, it's around chronic disease. And it's actually not the professionals who make the majority of the decisions that most influence outcomes. It's the patient, the family, the caregiver making decisions like, do I fill a prescription, complete it, diet, exercise, lifestyle, all kinds of things. That there could be the best doctoring in the world, but if those things don't get addressed in that you know, other 99% when they're not in front of the doctor and you're a provider and you're paid on outcomes, that becomes a disaster. So it just becomes a natural thing. It becomes natural to provide these kind of tools that allow for much greater two-way communication. And what's been provided in the past at best has been kind of a one-way broadcast of information. But really, you know, if they are full-fledged members of the team, it does need to be a two-way interchange.
You know, David, back in 2009, Congress passed the High-Tech Act, putting billions of dollars into health information exchanges and supporting practices in adopting electronic health records. And today there's hundreds of different electronic health record systems out there for providers, each touting their specific benefits. And oftentimes there are problems integrating those electronic health record systems between each other. So when it comes to personal health records focused on patients, nobody's really managed to get them engaged. So who do you see leading the effort to adopt your patient relationship management tools, and what will be the incentive for them to do so?
I would say that when you get the incentives aligned, it just becomes a natural byproduct of the care you provide when you're in this patient-centric, accountable, coordinated, kind of aligned model. Certainly, the federal incentives are going to be helpful there. But when you're in that model, again, it's just a natural byproduct. And whether it's Denmark or Kaiser Permanente or direct primary care models, they do those things. And when you're in the old model, the fee-for-service, quite frankly, things like the PHR and secure email that you might do with a patient tends to get viewed as just more unpaid work, and thus why you haven't seen much success there. It's one of the reasons why, you know, a company like ours, it's a relatively new entrant. You know, we've found those niches that we think represent what will become the mainstream as a whole when you get that alignment. And then, you know, again, it just becomes a natural way of doing business. Nobody had to provide UPS the ability to do package tracking and any number of things like that. It just becomes a logical, efficient way of doing things, just like every other area of your life. Really, healthcare has been the outlier there, and it's been the incentives more than anything that have kept that from going on. And I mean, as I say, you know, it's about the money. You know, reimbursement really matters, and it takes two to tango. And that being that if you just, you know, push patients out the door and say, hey, you know, get your act together on health or do these things, and there's no follow-up and no incentive by the provider, many patients, in fact, the vast majority, don't actually know what to do or forget what to do. And so that's, I think, why there's been a failure in the past, because there's been that lack of alignment.
Well, Dave, I'm going to ask you to maybe drill down one more level on that, because I think you're absolutely right. This is the new frontier, and I don't know if it's you or one of your colleagues who dug the empowered patient, the super drug of the 21st century, that breakthrough we've all been looking for, where we'll have a much bigger impact. But if you look at what's out there in the marketplace, you know, there's will on the part of the provider community, and then the IT companies have responded by having patient portals, and certainly iPhones have allowed us to communicate more ways by text messaging and so forth. But really, when I look around the country, still don't see a lot of patient engagement through those strategies, through the patient portal, through alternate ways of communicating with their providers. What do you see around the country or around the world in this area of engaging patients that you look at and say, aha, you know, that's a great strategy to engage people in?
I mean, there are a number of different examples. Certainly one that I'm bullish on is what's called direct primary care, or concierge medicine for the masses. And where they have done that, and they basically operate in a very efficient, low overhead manner. And so by necessity, they do things to make it very easy for patients to track their health remotely. You know, I'm afraid what we do today is the equivalent of, you know, we send patients to a foreign land called healthcare. You know, we give them directions in a second language, and then we push them out the door and say, if you get lost, come back and we'll try to give you directions again. And we, you know, it's pretty well understood that by the time people get to the parking lot, they've either never understood or they forgot 70 or 80% of what was told. There's certainly some doctors that, you know, from surgeons to pediatricians who are doing a terrific job around patient education and can recognize that today you have this kind of brutal combination of doctors are time starved, and then what do? Thousands of times a year, but essentially hit the replay button on the response to the FAQ to explain a diagnosis, a treatment, a medication. And what the smart ones are doing is they recognize they don't, you don't need to have Spielberg to pull out your smartphone and shoot a video that responds to those questions. And then in that time that you have with between the patient and the provider, they can have a more specific, nuanced conversation. And what these docs will say is they will start to go in their spiel, and the patients will say, you know, hey, time out, doc. I already, you know, watched that video or read that blog. Let's talk about my particular family situation. And, you know, patients are incredibly happy with that situation. It's a great contrast with what's done today. And, you know, there's no real cost to doing that. I mean, one doc says it's just his, I think he called it his 41st appointment that he would work into his schedule, and he'd just pull out the phone and, you know, take 3 minutes to answer some question he'd commonly get. And, you know, in a pretty short amount of time, he had a nice library of personalized content. So, again, typical patient portals wouldn't address that. And there's nice tools to be able to do that now.
We're speaking today with David Chase, founder and CEO of Avado, a patient portal and relationship management system aimed at bringing the patient directly into the care team. He's responsible for numerous health IT and consumer engagement startups. He has reviewed or implemented over 100 health IT systems across the country. Dave, let's take a look at some of the early attempts to launch interactive personal health record systems. Microsoft Vault continues to evolve, but the other big player, Google Health, didn't get far off the launching pad before shutting down its operations. Where do you think they went wrong in their approach, and what have you learned from observing that failure?
One, there was a timing aspect where the incentives weren't there some years back, and so that reduced the motivation on the part of providers to do that. But I actually think the biggest thing was there was too much work required by the consumer, and it was a one-sided product. I mean, there needs to be a provider side of this. As I mentioned earlier, it does take two to tango. And so simply having sort of almost like a special case of Dropbox where you can just store stuff is fine, but it's not enough. You know, unfortunately, some of the folks who have come in, while you can come in from the outside and say healthcare is broken, I've got a better way, you do need to understand the nuances and the idiosyncrasies of healthcare and how things are paid. And I think they just addressed one piece of the puzzle rather than the entire mix. And I think that's really what has kept all of those from getting any kind of meaningful adoption.
Dave, you mentioned direct primary care a few moments back. And for our listeners, some have called that concierge medicine, where patients access health care outside the health insurance system or in addition to the health insurance system by paying a membership fee basically to a primary care provider. And for that fee, they gain access to their primary care provider anytime they want, and often in smaller panels than they might find in a traditional practice. And that's gathered some support in what one might think are unusual areas. I know the founder of the financial microloan system, a Nobel Prize winner, has supported that. But it's often thought of as a system for the wealthy to sort of buy a higher level of care. And yet I think you've presented it as possibly the opposite, also a way to signal an innovative approach to healthcare delivery of kind of do-it-yourself organizing your medicine. Maybe tell us just a little more about that. And what do you see as both the impact in this time of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, but also beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, it has taken place in the context of what I call, you know, do-it-yourself health reform, where it's just been entrepreneurs doing that. Having said that, there is a very little-known clause in the Affordable Care Act that does allow for these direct primary care medical homes to sit inside of the health insurance exchanges. You know, that's sort of a coming thing. So in the meantime, these have gotten off the ground. And, you know, historically, a criticism of concierge medicine is that it creates a two-tier healthcare system. And, you know, I think that there's a number of many examples. I mean, for one, the price point generally is, so you mentioned the one by the Nobel Peace Prize winner with Grameen America, and they are initially addressing the undocumented immigrants who are borrowers. There's 17,000 borrowers of these microloans in the U.S. a lot of people know about their work internationally, but didn't know that they have done that in the U.S. And it's $10 a week, which they can afford. And that's not as charity. That is to be an economically self-sustaining model. And the irony is, you know, I've often rejected this notion of it creating a two-tier system because it's so affordable. And now I'm sort of agreeing there's a two-tier system. It's actually the lower-income people who have the direct primary care model are actually getting a better quality care than the richer middle and upper-income people because they're not subject to the seven-minute drive-by appointments that have become the norm in primary care. So it's kind of an ironic twist that it's actually the lower-income people, not exclusively, but in these examples, who are getting, you know, great care. And if you look at that triple aim we talked about, I've seen no model that has achieved the triple aim better than these direct primary care models in terms of reducing costs, improving outcomes, and they have patient satisfaction rates that are better than Google or Apple. So it's really quite phenomenal what they're doing.
We'll keep an eye on that. In particular, as the Affordable Care Act rolls out, the undocumented will not be covered under that. So it will be an interesting model to keep an eye on. But let's take a look at the future of tech-enabled healthcare and the engaged patient. And you've quoted William Gibson in a recent article in Forbes saying the future is here. It just happens to be uneven. We've had forward thinkers on our show like Eric Topol and ePatient Dave, sort of envisioning a future that fully embeds the engaged patient as part of the care team and bypasses the old way of care delivery with adoptive technologies. And so with so many systems emerging simultaneously and the healthcare law driving the population towards full coverage, how do you see all of these forces helping achieve the triple aim, as you were just talking about, as of better access, better outcomes, and lower cost in healthcare for the future?
Well, yes. I mean, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that it will play out that way. You know, I tend to be a congenital optimist and see great examples where it does. And when you get into, we just spoke about direct primary care. There's actually some Medicare Advantage programs that have done phenomenal work here. And the interesting thing is that they've realized that if they take time with patients and, in, you know, particularly with the elderly, with their family and caregivers to explain their choices without being a gatekeeper like the old HMO model, but just simply having an informed, engaged, either patient and or care, you know, family care team, in many, many cases, probably the majority of the time, they actually choose the less invasive route because they're informed of significant risk, particularly when you talk about the frail elderly, where, you know, when you go into some surgery or transplant or whatever, that is not without risk. And in many cases, there are alternatives where the quality of life can be significantly better. And so, you know, that William Gibson quote is one I like because if you took those models that already exist in pockets around the country addressing different patient populations, whether it's a Medicaid population here, a Medicare there, private insured there, and scaled those up, you essentially don't need to do anything else to essentially solve healthcare. It's just that's not been brought together into one integrated whole into one place. And I think that's where, you know, there's a tremendous opportunity and some exciting things going on in some communities like Tampa that are really trying to step up and be that place where that whole is brought together.
We've been speaking today with David Chase, founder and CEO of Avado, a patient portal and relationship management system that's aimed at bringing the patient directly into the care team. You can learn more about his new venture by going to avado.com, and you can find him on LinkedIn. Or Dave, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
It's been my pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, this week we'll look at who's exempt from the individual mandate that's part of the Affordable Care Act. This is the requirement that starting in 2014, people have to have health insurance or pay a fine. So who's exempt from this? Well, it's mainly low-income individuals, such as those who earn too little to be required to file tax returns. For 2012, that was those earning under $9,750 a year or $19,500 for married couples. Also exempt are employees who can't afford their work-based insurance. These are employees who would have to pay more than 8% of household income for coverage, and those who can't get an affordable offer of coverage on the insurance exchanges. There are also exemptions for hardships in obtaining coverage, and those are determined by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The law also exempts those who have gaps in coverage of less than 3 months, members of Indian tribes, members of a health care sharing ministry, and members of certain religious groups that are already exempt from Social Security taxes. That last category is made up mainly of Anabaptist groups, such as Mennonite or Amish. Also exempt, those who are in jail. A few readers have asked us about Americans who are living overseas. Those who live abroad for a full calendar year are exempt, but those who live in another country temporarily are not. Also, residents of U.S. territories do not have to comply with the mandate. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In one of the most popular TED Talks of all time, game developer Dr. Jane McGonigal made a pretty bold prediction.
If we want to solve problems like hunger, poverty, climate change, global conflict, obesity, I believe that we need to aspire to play games online for at least 21 billion hours a week by the end of the next decade. No, I'm serious. I am.
McGonigal is the director of games research and development at the Institute for the Future, and she's a thought leader in the growing trend of the gamification of improving health and social well-being through interactive video games. But she didn't realize that her prediction would come home to roost on her own doorstep. After suffering a severe concussion in 2009, she succumbed to the classic symptoms of traumatic brain injury: constant pain, chronic headaches, fog, depression, even suicidal ideation.
In all seriousness, suicidal ideation is quite common with traumatic brain injuries. It happens to 1 in 3, and it happened to me. My brain started telling me, "Jane, you want to die." And these voices became so persistent and so persuasive that I started to legitimately fear for my life.
So she created the game Super Better. McGonigal's research shows that when people engage in gaming, they're more likely to reach out for help, to empower themselves through their game avatar, and to use the avatar to slay the symptoms they're battling. In her own case, so McGonigal's avatar became Jane the Concussion Slayer.
Adopt a secret identity, recruit your allies, battle the bad guys, activate the power-ups. Within just a couple days of starting to play, that fog of depression and anxiety went away. It just vanished.
Within a year, the other symptoms, the headache and the fog, dissipated and went away. She decided to put the game online for anyone to access, and the feedback totally unexpected.
Not everybody has a concussion, obviously. Not everyone wants to be the slayer. So I renamed the game Super Better. And soon I started hearing from people all over the world who were adopting their own secret identity, recruiting their own allies, and they were getting super better, facing challenges like cancer and chronic pain, depression and Crohn's disease. Even people were playing it for terminal diagnoses like ALS.
Now McGonigal is working with the U.S. military to assist the hundreds of thousands of GIs dealing with traumatic brain injury and PTSD. She says that the game revealed a phenomena that scientists call post-traumatic growth, where some people experience dramatic growth after a traumatic event. The game just seems to get people to that place more quickly. Super Better, a simple online game that allows players grappling with all kinds of conditions to battle their symptoms in order to better manage and hopefully defeat their condition. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Mazzelli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.